You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. All right, in the March issue of Bon Appetit, we've got this big 20-page feature called Generation Next, in which we realize that so many of the restaurants we are most excited by right now in the United States are being run by the children of immigrants, and that these are kids who grew up in the United States but have taken the food, the traditional foods they grew up eating from their moms or dads, and sort of turbocharged them and reinvented them for the American restaurant scene. From a Texas take on ramen in Austin, Texas, to a vegan Polish joint in Pittsburgh, this is some of the most exciting and delicious food going on right now in America. So I called Reem Asil of Reem's Wraps in Oakland, California, where she makes manaish, a flatbread from the Levant, and tops them with all sorts of locally grown California produce. We talked to Reem about her childhood, her community organizing in the Bay Area, and the trip to Syria that inspired her to open Reem's. And just one note, we recorded this on a Skype phone call, so might not have that rich, smooth, syrupy tones as you're used to. After that, I sit down with our own Andy Baragani, senior food editor here at BA, and he walks us through how to make his feast for Nowruz, the Persian New Year. You can find all of those recipes in our March issue of Bon Appetit. All right, here's Reem Asil. Reem, thanks for coming on the Bon Appetit Foodcast. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here.
And yeah, where is here?
I am currently in San Francisco at the La Cocina headquarters, where Reem's California currently operates.
Cool. Are you like in a stairwell or something, or a nice sort of a conference room or something?
Yeah. My makeshift office here. There's about 30 businesses at any given time.
That's awesome. So you wrote a nice short piece for us in our March issue as part of our Generation Next feature story about sort of being a community activist turned restaurateur / chef. And my first thought was like, well, how does the former prepare you at all to be the latter, going from community activism to like making food and running a business? How the heck did this happen?
Yeah, actually, ironically, I've been reflecting on this a lot, how I'm really glad that I have my community organizing skills to get me through what it takes to be an entrepreneur. A lot of the skills are translatable, particularly because the Reem's brand is really about connecting community. So it's a natural transition. But I've always sort of had a passion for three things, I would say, you know, my culture, being in community, whatever that may be, and what different points of my life, and food. And so when I was sort of in this crossroads in my life where I was working tons and tons of hours as a community organizer and sort of in the fight and disillusioned because I wasn't seeing the change that I wanted to see. I was sort of at this crossroads of what is my purpose? You know, I was very, I'm very dramatic. That's always kind of the crossroads that I come to, like, I need to have a purpose in life. but I didn't want to be a professional organizer per se. I didn't want to work in the nonprofit world. I wanted to sort of affect change from a different lens. It was really a trip that I took to the Middle East, and it was ironically a soul-searching trip for my own sort of connection to my identity and culture that led me to the idea of Reem's, because it really connected those three passions of, you know, my culture and my heritage, a way to build community because I saw it in my very own, you know, before my very own eyes, sort of what the power of food and particularly the bakery culture was in my homeland.
Yeah, you had mentioned going to Syria with your father, and sensing that sense of community when you go to bakeries and people would be hanging out and catching up with each other and being social. And that's interesting about restaurants, is that I think we don't necessarily think of food and activism as always going hand in hand, but food and community they're linked at the wrist. You know, you go to restaurants and cafes and bakeries to catch up with each other and spend time with each other. And And it's interesting when we talk, and like if you look in America, I imagine in refugee communities, the first question people always ask is like, oh, are there any good Syrian restaurants here or Lebanese restaurants or Chinese? You know, it's like that's where those communities gather, right?
Yeah. Well, people want to feel a sense of home, you know, because they've been uprooted from what their sort of concept of home is. And so I think food is a very easy way to connect people to home, you know, through the senses and through sort of, you know, like connecting to other people who are like them, who they can culturally relate to. And so, but food and activism is also very, I would love to do like a history project on sort of where food intersected with revolutions.
Mm. Well, I think you always see that also with revolutions. Anytime there's a food shortage, it's been very well documented that people rise up and rebel.
But I also think it's like, I say food is the new frontier for organizing. It's a way like you reel them in with the food and you connect and you build that trust. And then that's a way to engage people. And that was something that I really wanted to do. This was, you know, we're living in a post 9/11 world and now even more so like in this sort of, Trump era, it's so important to be engaging people on a deeper level, you know, like maybe it's that they like the bread and then they ask a few questions about the bread and then it gets into the history of the Middle East and so on and so forth. So I just think that food is like the new frontier of engaging folks and organizing them.
Well, it gets, you know, people sitting down and talking. But the first thing you have to do is make good food, which is obviously easier said than done. So you're over in Syria with your father. Yep. You're eating this delicious manoush, which is like a Syrian flatbread and a lot of local Middle Eastern cuisine over there. What made you think that you could come home and recreate a version of that food in America to the point that people would want to pay money for it?
I remember telling my mom that's what I was going to do. And she was like, oh my God, I don't think the Americans are ready for this. Like, they're not going to like it. And I was like, I'm a classic overachiever. And so I was like, well, I'm going to find a way for them to like it. It's like pizza, you know?
What year is this?
This is in 2011.
Okay. Yeah. You know what? You know what Americans like? They like carbs. They like their carbohydrates.
Everybody loves their bread. Like, the bakery culture is not something that's unique to Arab culture. I think like, you know, cause I spent 3 years working at Arizmendi and I was just there this morning and it's the same regulars from like when I worked there 5 years ago.
Where did you learn to bake and when did you realize that you had a talent?
So I was a master, like I said, I'm like type A overachiever. So I was like, okay, I'm going to open this bakery, but I got to build the skills. So when I got back, I enrolled myself in a baking and pastry program at a local college here in Oakland at Laney College and started to learn my ways. And then I, you know, started nerded out on bread books and sort of just like read a lot, going to school, reading. And then I was very fortunate to have landed a job at one of the premier bakeries here in Oakland. It's a sister cooperative of what most people nationally might know, the Cheese Board Collective.
Sure.
For 3.5 years, I learned sort of the ins and outs of bread and pastry making. And then I slowly made the shift to think about sort of how do I incorporate some of the things that I was learning about California cuisine and sort of translate that to bread making and Arab culture.
All right, I want to talk about the business, but first I want to talk about the food. So what are you making that is so delicious that people in the Bay Area are like, oh, this Reem gal, she knows what she's doing. I want to get some of that. Like, sell me on your wraps.
We have the secret sauce, which is our bread, really. I'm Palestinian Syrian, and so my family, one of the quintessential street foods in what we call the Levantine region, the Fertile Crescent, some people call it, it's called a manoushe. Manoushe is fresh baked flatbread. Traditionally, it's topped with a spice mix called za'atar, and za'atar is like a staple spice mix in every Arab household. It's composed of It's a wild thyme, and we mix it with sumac berry, sesame seeds, little bit of salt and olive oil. I'm a purist. Those are the four ingredients I put in there. It's like a pesto, and we slather it up onto the bread. And traditionally, you can either make these breads in a very high heat, wood-fired or gas oven, or on a traditional, how we bake it, in the street food setting, on a traditional griddle called a saj. A saj is basically like a dome. It's like a tandoor oven inverted.
Cool. So you've got the warm bread, you've got the za'atar, which is pretty common these days in the States. If you want to go out and find it, a lot of markets carry it now, especially any Middle Eastern market. I love it because it's, that sesame seed plus the herbs, plus there's that sort of almost oily grittiness to it, it adheres to bread really nicely. So that's making me hungry. What do you put on the manouche?
So that's like in its hot form, it comes off the griddle or out of the oven, and then we top it with fresh vegetables. And, at Reims, our za'atar manouche is called the classic. And the classic topping is tomatoes, cucumbers, and fresh mint. And then you can add on a bunch of different things. So how I like my classic is with tomatoes, cucumbers, mint, and then put dollops of labneh, which is a thick strain yogurt that we make, and avocado for the California love.
Yes. What about do you do breakfast manouches with like a little egg or anything in there? Is that possible?
Yeah. So at our morning markets, we have something called the Golden State.
That's a good one. I get it.
We scramble eggs with our signature shakshuka sauce. It's a mix of roasted peppers and red peppers and tomatoes with Aleppo and an amazing red sauce. And we mix it with the scrambled egg, and then it gets baked onto cheese, a cheesy bread. And then it comes off, and we top it with tomatoes, parsley, and a little bit of fresh goat cheese and wrap it all up. So it's like basically like our version of the breakfast burrito.
Yeah. as they say, every culture has its burrito. Have any Golden State Warriors ever had any of your flatbreads?
No. It's my goal. In the spring, we have the Draymond Green.
Oh, man.
And it's like a...
You really are a Warrior fan. Jesus.
I am a Warriors fan for life. And the Draymond Green is sort of an homage to Draymond Green, but also my Arizmendi roots, because it's an asparagus pizza with goat cheese and red onion, sumac spiced red onions and parsley. It's really, really green. And so we're like, what are we going to call this thing? And of course, that was what I came up with.
I think you need you should put a lot of hot sauce on there or something, because he's a real fiery dude, you know?
Yes, totally. Well, we put the goat cheese because I like the greatest of all time sort of thing going on there.
I hate to say it, but Draymond's not the greatest
of
all time.
He's not the greatest of all time. But
he's not even the greatest. He's not even the greatest on the team.
Oh, man. But he's the fire of that team. He's the heart of that team.
He's the engine.
No, but I do have dreams. I do have daydreams of like a tall Draymond Green walking up to our stand. I even thought about doing a curry flatbread.
Oh, yeah. Duh.
But I haven't figured out what that would look like. And well,
that
how
would
to
actually,
make it a
but that would be really interesting. Like, what would a Middle Eastern curry be? Like, how could you take a basic curry and infuse it with some traditional Middle Eastern flavors?
Totally. Yeah, wow. We do. We use a lot of turmeric in our stuff. Like, we have a turmeric tea cake. Like, we use it in our sweets. We have it in our drinks. So, yeah, maybe I'll make my own curry.
Let's get on that. All right. So, my question is this. So, what's interesting, from a business standpoint, it seems like you've taken a path that a lot of young restaurateurs have as of late. Instead of opening just like a big fancy restaurant or whatever, you've kind of done like the pop-up thing, the food truck thing, kind of going about it sort of back end instead of coming through the front door with a giant lease and expenses and all that sort of stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
Was that by design?
A little bit. I think, I think the reality is that I could never even dream of the amount of money that it would take to open a restaurant. And so I think La Cucina really helped me make that a reality, because when I first came in, I wanted to do I wanted to do sort of like those Neapolitan pizza guys, like a wood-fired oven on a truck and I was like 10,000 feet up in the air, and like La Cucina really helped bring me back down.
So what is your brick and mortar space going to be? When's it going to open? Where's it going to be?
So it's in the heart of the Fruitvale neighborhood in Oakland, at the what people know as the Fruitvale Station.
Okay.
It's literally right off of the BART, which is like going to be great because our food is really a commuter food. We want to be part of, when I imagine Reams, I wanted it to be a place where people convene, but also to be a practical place where we could just be part of people's daily lives, like their daily routines, and no better way to do that on a commuter line.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, it's a 2,063 square foot space with like 1,500 square feet of courtyard space. So like there's going to be a real outdoor scene.
Wow. Are you going to grow any vegetables or anything out back?
Yeah. So the design is very centered on a lot of planter beds, but we're also sort of in the works of trying to figure out a plot of land to grow our za'atar locally. It's an herb that's very, very prevalent in the Middle East. And that climate is very similar to up here in Northern California. So I want to sort of replicate
that. Wait. I went to college in the Bay Area, and I've been to like Middle East, Israel area. Like Bay Area, it's cold and damp and foggy. Like that is nothing like the Middle East.
Okay. So it is actually like, in the Middle East just in the summer, but it's a very temperate climate. I mean, you have the mountains, you have the ocean, and you have the woods all in like driving distance of each other.
Okay.
You go to Lebanon, yeah, you get all of that climate. And it's a drought resistant plant.
That is a good point. I think in the Middle East, I think so many of us Americans think of the Middle East as summer, hot, deserty. But if you're there in November and December, it is, especially in the mountainous regions, it is a very different climate. Will you be able to, when you open, are there any menu items you'll open with that you'll be able to cook in a freestanding restaurant that you haven't been able to do on your mobile kitchens or whatnot?
Yeah, we're really excited. We have a whole line of croissants where we're doing some of our flavors, but we'll have a whole line of stews and braises that are very traditional also in the street food setting that we haven't been able to do because it's just like so much work.
What kind of stews and braises, for instance?
Yeah, so the one that I'm excited about, so we have a dish called fete in Arabic. It's like basically like our fried bread soaked with like a yogurt sauce. And there's different kinds, but we'll do braised lamb. We'll have a vegetarian version that's like about with chickpeas and pomegranate and pine nuts. And you take the bread, the fried bread, it's like on the bottom. And then you like, you know, you put the braise on top and then you throw the yogurt on top. It's going to be very beautiful. And then it soaks that fried bread up and then you eat it. And it's like garnished with pomegranate molasses and pine nuts and parsley. In the Middle East, you actually have like, it gets scooped up right in front of you. It's like such a fun thing to see.
Yeah. That sounds delicious. And you'll be open. Will you do breakfast, lunch and dinner and really make it an all day hangout sort of spot?
Yeah, we'll probably start off as a sort of breakfast, lunch, and early dinner. And as we get more popular, sort of one of the things that we want to do is revive that area in the evening and make it a real hangout spot where people can come off the BART and like, you know, enjoy a drink and watch the Warriors game.
Wow. I hope the Warriors are paying you. Have you noticed Middle Eastern cuisine becoming more of a thing nationally among sort of new trendiest restaurants? I mean, I feel like I have in like restaurants like Tusk in Portland, or with, you know, Dizengoff's and Zahav in Philadelphia and Mad Capra and stuff in LA. And the fact that the fact that hummus is now like the most basic snack food in America, like is kind of crazy.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think Middle Eastern cuisine has always sort of been in the backdrop, but, I think for a number of reasons, and I think most of it, like sort of the immigrant experience here in this country, it's like you're just trying to get by. And, you know, like some of the food is really good, but sort of under, you know, like unless you know, you know, they're like, they look like holes in the walls. And then on the other extreme, I feel like a lot of people have like sort of taken away Middle Eastern food or made it like Mediterranean, or, you know, sort of expanded it to be more palatable to the American palate.
Sure.
Or like the, you know, so like, I feel like there's not enough Arab chefs out there who are really sort of making their mark. And it's like, feels exciting to be a woman and to sort of make my mark as a Syrian Palestinian, to kind of share this cuisine. And, you know, I have a privilege because I was born and raised here to be able to translate it in a way that people understand. So
you kind of know what people will like while still being able to have a sense of authenticity. I also think it's interesting with so much of Middle Eastern cuisine now with in America, obviously there's been this, you know, more, as we say, healthy-ish push in these last several years. Yeah. And you were talking about your classic flatbread with tomatoes and cucumbers and avocado, and that what is basic Middle Eastern cuisine for thousands of years all of a sudden is very in sync with like what how Americans are eating now.
Exactly. It's convenient, it's healthy, and nobody is going to refuse fresh baked bread out of the oven.
No.
It's just like,
but fresh baked bread with good vegetables and some labneh, no one is going to say no to that. And you throw some eggs on there and forget about it.
Yeah. Farm fresh egg on there, like that's what they like here in California, I'm sure everywhere else.
When is the restaurant opening, do you think?
Yes. So we're anticipating, my target goal is by the end of April, we'll be doing a series of soft openings and then sort of a grand opening in May.
And you're calling it Reams?
It's Reams, California. And that's just something that people started calling me Reams, California, and like sort of grew on me. And
so April, May, Fruitvale Station, Oakland. Before we let you go, Reem, we're going to hit you with the lightning round.
Oh.
So you got either or questions, a couple of quick ones you got to answer.
Oh, God.
Ready to do this?
All right. Yeah, do it.
All right. Morning bun or country loaf? This is a tartine
morning
question.
Bun.
Really? I've never had the morning bun. I've only seen the morning bun in Instagrams, and I'm always like, ooh, that does look good. Is it really that good?
It's amazing. And we're going to have one at Reams. It's going to be the cardamom orange blossom morning bun.
Oh, and kind of in tartine style?
Tartine style, yeah.
Nice.
In fact, I'm getting folks from Tartine helping me figure out how to make it.
Very cool. Because you're in San Francisco, carnitas or carne asada?
Ooh, I would say carne asada. My husband is from San Diego, and we live off of carne asada.
Does he cook at all?
Yeah.
Say no more. Labneh or goat cheese?
Labneh.
Any brands you recommend in terms for the person who's just purchasing labneh at home?
Oh, man, there's nothing like homemade labneh. I'm a purist.
All right.
Byblos, B-Y-B-L-O-S.
Okay, cool.
That's the one that's popular in the stores now, I think.
All right, this is a tough one. Steph or Clay?
Oh, why do you have to do that?
You got
to
pick one, dude.
I'm going to have to go with Clay.
Really?
Yeah.
Clay Thompson over two-time MVP Steph Curry. Steph just got kicked to the curb. Wow.
Ah, you made me pick, though.
Bart or Carr?
I would say Bart. Driving makes me anxious.
Yeah. Tell us about it. All right. Last question before we go. Butter or olive oil?
Oh, I love me some butter, but I have to stay true to my roots and say olive oil.
All right. There you go.
I'll be a horrible Palestinian if I didn't say olive oil.
Reem Vasile, thank you very much for joining us via Skype.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Andy Baragani, may I wish you an early Happy New Year?
Oh, thank you, Adam.
How does one wish one a Happy New Year in the Persian culture?
In Farsi, you say Eid Shoma Mubarak.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
It's Eid Shoma Mubarak, which means Happy New Year's.
I like that. You know what I like about this holiday? Although I haven't ever celebrated because you have not invited me to your house. That's one reason. This year it's happening. I like the fact that it's on March 21st-ish, the first day of spring.
Yep. Non-political, non-religious. It just, it's about rebirth and it's about the first day of spring and getting people together and eat a lot of food.
Yeah. And it's like, that makes sense for the new year and in the Western calendar, whatever we call, what do we call that? The Western calendar? Is it the, I always forget.
I'm sorry.
I know what it is. But anyways, like December 31st, like that makes no sense.
It makes
whatsoever.
No sense at all. No. There's a lot of symbolism behind Nowruz. I mean, it's a holiday that's been celebrated for well over 3,000 years.
Yeah, but it makes sense. First day of spring, the earth is waking up, the flowers are blooming, the vegetables are sprouting up. It's the start, you know, it's the days are getting longer. Mm-hmm. So it feels right.
It feels right.
Yes, you mentioned eating a lot of food.
Yeah, I mean, growing up, this was a huge deal. It's a 13-day holiday, so it's not like just a one-day thing. Mm. It really starts off with the Tuesday before the New Year, where you jump over little fires to get rid of the bad spirits.
Okay.
And you eat this thick legume noodle soup known as Osheresh, and it's incredible. It's has toasted wheat noodles that kind of look like linguine.
Yep.
A lot of herbs, of course. And then
herbs signifying spring in general.
Exactly. And then you have cranberry beans, you have chickpeas, you have lentils, and then it's topped with kashk, which is kind of this dried yogurt that has a little bit of ground wheat to it, and then it's rehydrated and drizzled over the soup.
Whoa.
With sizzled mint and crispy onions and crispy garlic, and it's incredible.
Are the beans kind of al dente? Are they kind of mushy a little?
They're on the mushy side, for sure. It's very, like very thick.
Yeah, I like that. And you grew up in the Bay Area?
Grew up in the Bay Area, East Bay.
So you're pre-gaming a week prior.
Yeah, pre-gaming a week prior. And then for the big celebration on the day of the Nowruz, obviously the whole family gets together. And it's a menu that it consists of rice, obviously.
Why do you say obviously?
Because it's just, you go to any Iranian household, the cook is judged by how they make their rice.
Ooh, wow.
It's tough.
I love you say judged, as if people are walking out like, Mrs. Baragani, she's pretty, how was your mom's rice game?
It is incredible. I went back to California a month ago, and I landed at like 10 o'clock at night, got home, and my mom already had some food ready for me, and her rice is still better than mine.
And you're a professional cook.
Yes, I was very frustrated. I was like, Mom, like, this is really good. She's like, you probably just don't put enough salt or butter to it. I was like.
So you walk in the household with your dirty laundry bag.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh,
come from New York to California.
And you feature a rice recipe in the March issue of Bon Appetit. You have an article, a recipe story on Nowruz and dishes to celebrate with. Let's talk about the meal itself. I mean, is it multi-courses or is everything on the table at once? What are some of the dishes that you are sort of classics?
It's pretty much all the food on the table at once. The rice is typical basmati rice. And
wait, question. When you say typical basmati rice, because now when I go to the grocery store and the Whole Foods and whatnot, there's like Texamati and all these different sort of riffs on basmati. If I want to get the good stuff, what am I buying?
You know what? Actually, I shouldn't say typical because I think everybody knows that I'm a rice fanatic. I think it's, you got to look for basmati rice that has a kind of golden hue to it that almost looks a little bit ashy, you know that it's been aged properly. And then from there, you need to, the way Persian rice is made, you rinse it until the water is clear, and then you soak it for about an hour at least.
Yeah, you're a little particular about rinsing
yes,
and soaking
absolutely.
Sort of thing.
Absolutely. You want to get the excess starch out. That's really the whole deal.
So it won't clump together?
So it won't clump together. That's the big thing. For Persian rice, polo, we say, which translates to like pilaf. The rice should never stick and the rice should never be broken. It should be fluffy and you should be able to tell each individual grain.
So you're rinsing multiple times and then soaking and then rinsing again?
No, soaking and then you drain it and then you parboil it in salted water. The water should be salty like pasta water, basically. Okay. You drain that, you rinse the water just a bit to stop the cooking, and then you pour the rice back into the pot. And you pile it up to like a mountain, a big mound. Uh-huh. You poke a few holes so the steam could rise. And then you place a lid on top. And you cover the lid with a kitchen towel so that the steam, the towel will absorb the steam. So that
doesn't drip back
on it. So it doesn't drip back. Yeah, so you don't have mushy rice.
So you're putting the moist, wet rice back in. And then the rice is steaming just with the moisture in the rice itself.
Exactly.
You're not putting in more water. And then how long do you do that for, that second one?
I go at least 25 to 35 minutes. Sometimes you can
Low heat?
Over low heat. Some people, they even go even lower heat and they go for like a full hour. Some people will soak their rice for a day. I mean, it depends on the cook. It is a huge thing.
So after all this, the rice is done? Yes?
It is done.
And then what happens?
And then there's two ways you could serve it. You could either invert the pot. Which people like to do. It's easier.
What do you mean?
They'll put a platter over the pot.
Oh, okay. And
then
they'll
flip it, and then you could kind of cut the rice into wedges. I didn't grow up with that.
Oh, because, well, hold on a second. All right, because you're saying that when it is cooking that second time after the parboiling, it develops a crispy bottom?
It should. Well, you need to pour. If you want the crispy bottom, that's a whole
Well, who doesn't want the crispy bottom? That's a whole thing. So, but
the tadik.
All right, well, let's not get into tadik. So if you're doing it this way, it still gets a little crispy. Why are you flipping it over?
You'll flip it over. It's just a kind of easier way to serve it. Mm-hmm. If you want the crispy rice, then you would have to.
But you said be able to cut it so it retains its shape
in
the pot?
It will retain its shape, yep.
So it's not all like fluffy and loose then?
It'll be fluffy inside. It won't be necessarily like a... It will never be sticky because you've already rinsed it and soaked it.
I have a feeling this entire podcast is going to be about rice. So you flip it over on a platter. It's the shape of a pot, kind of.
Yes.
And you can cut it into wedges.
Yes. But then obviously the rice will kind of spill because it's not clumpy or sticky.
No, of course not. But then is it just rice or are you mixing in other sort of flavoring agents?
So like for Nowruz, you eat sabzi polo. And sabzi means herbs. So what you do is you... add a mixture of herbs. We use cilantro, parsley, dill. Sometimes you could use fenugreek if you can find it, tarragon, mint, and you add the fresh herbs to the rice.
When?
You add it just after it's been parboiled. You'll mix in the fresh herbs, yeah.
Oh, so those cook along with it in
exactly.
The... Fascinating. Yeah. Okay. Well, and what about butter or salt?
You'll add the butter about 3/4 of the way it's done, or when you lift the lid, you'll add the butter and let it continue to cook for a bit just so the butter melts. The rice has already been done at that point.
And follow your mom's advice, add more butter than you think.
Add more butter than you think.
Okay, so we have this delicious, I could eat a lot of rice.
I feel like
I'm like the guy that orders the fried rice like from my favorite Chinese place, and I just eat the entire thing by myself. Okay, so we got this delicious rice going. What else do we have on the table?
So you have the sabzi polo, and then you always have, it's called sabzi polo mahi. So you have the sabzi polo, but then you need to have mahi, which is the fish. And the fish is prepared in two ways. You'll either have smoked white fish, or you'll have baked.
Are you just buying the smoked white fish?
You're just buying smoked white fish and then reheating it.
Cool.
Or you'll have some kind of baked fish.
Okay.
I grew up where my mom would do salmon. She just would do like a whole fillet of salmon. She'll sprinkle some saffron, some turmeric, salt, pepper, some lemon juice, oil, and bake it.
All right. Simple
Easy.
Enough.
I went a little bit different. I used black bass, whole black bass, butterflied it, and stuffed it.
Why black bass?
I like black bass. I want to do a white fish. Mm-hmm. I don't know why my mother did salmon growing up. I think because she likes salmon. That's why. And she and she does and she doesn't like smoked whitefish. That's why. We only got a little bit for my father.
Well, she's a cook. She can decide. So then in terms of it, you just need some type of fish on the table.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And this one in the magazine, you did the black bass. You could probably use other sort of whitefish.
Any kind of whitefish, you would ask your fishmonger to butterfly the fish. And then what I did, because this really, the whole menu consists of a lot of herbs. So I took shallots, and I like a little bit of heat, some green chili, and again, mixture of dill, parsley, cilantro, and then cooked that down until a lot of the kind of the herbs kind of dried up a bit and their excess moisture evaporated, and then stuffed the fish with this spicy herb mixture.
What are we drinking?
What are we drinking? If it was my parents' household, it would typically be white wine.
Okay.
But afterwards, probably a lot of whiskey. And
really?
Or tequila. Yeah, I feel
like.
I don't know what it is. I think Iranians, they really love their whiskey or tequila. I am a gin guy, so I don't know what happened.
Okay, that's interesting. Are you hosting this year in New York, or are you going home?
I am hosting this year for the first time in New York City. I am. I'm not nervous. I'm more nervous about finding the right space because my apartment's a tiny studio apartment.
How many are you going to try to stuff in there?
Probably at 12, maybe 16. I'm going to have my mom send the rice. She doesn't know about that yet, but
what do you mean, like the rice?
Oh, she ships me the rice, like the rice that she gets in California. She'll send it to me. Because the rice that she gets in California is better than any rice that I could find in New York.
Why is that? Where does she get that rice from?
She'll get it. She just finds these certain brands. There's a large Iranian community in California. Uh-huh. So
is the rice coming from Iran, the rice itself? Or where's the rice?
A lot of the basmati rice you get here is from Pakistan or India. Okay. And she'll find these brands that I can't find.
She's got a guy.
She's got a guy. And I'll ask her, and she's like, "This, honey, it's going to cost me $23 to send this package over." And I'm like, I need it tomorrow. It's worth it, yeah.
Is there a non-fish entree that someone like me might like? Wow.
No, it's really, the fish is it's huge. This is the most important, the herb rice and the smoked or roasted fish. It's a big thing. I can't imagine having.
I can just eat more
rice.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many other items on the table.
And I want to talk about that. There's this insanely deep green, kind of like a frittata. Yeah. What is going on here? So what do we call this?
So it's called kuku sabzi, and it's basically like a Persian frittata. And there's a lot of different types of kukus, but kuku sabzi is the most, it's the one you see most often. And it is basically a frittata made with, again, a lot of herbs.
Yeah, right here. And the recipe you call for 1.5 cups chopped cilantro, 1.5 cups chopped dill, 1.5 cups chopped parsley. I want to say that's 4.5 cups herbs.
Yes.
To 5 eggs. So you basically have a cup of herbs for every egg.
You really don't have a lot of eggs. It's really just to bind everything together, the 5 eggs. And you have fenugreek.
And let's talk about fenugreek. Because I think it seems like one of those old world sort of herby spices.
Yes.
Like, talk to me about
it. So you'll see the seed a lot in Indian food. In Persian cuisine, you'll see a lot of the leaves. It's dried fenugreek, and it has a kind of almost a slightly bitter, like, tastes kind of like a celery leaf.
Yeah.
And then just a sprinkle does the trick, and it gives it a very particular aroma, the dish.
It's interesting how, like, one herb or spice can all of a sudden bring you back to somewhere. It's just like that, that flavor.
It's
you know?
Incredible. And the smell, I mean, it lingers for days in your house. It's just unbelievable. But too much of it ends up making the dish a little bit bitter. So you have to be careful.
So you have this, like I said, this very deep green frittata. I mean, there's no yellow in this frittata.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And there's a very yummy looking yogurt situation you got here.
So we love our yogurt and, which we call a must. And there's different variations. The one that you'll see, for the new year, you'll see must khiyar. Khiyar is cucumber. So, it's yogurt, cucumber, similar like a tzatziki, but.
What kind of yogurt are you using?
So in the recipe, I called for Greek yogurt.
which is very accessible.
Very accessible. Yes. The yogurt, Persian yogurt, is a little different because it's in between kind of the typical like American style yogurt that's very thin compared to it's in the middle between Greek yogurt and American yogurt.
Can you find it here in New York?
You could find it. I've seen it at Colusian's, Sahari's will have it, and it's really delicious. But since it's not easy to find all over, I just called for Greek yogurt and kind of thin it out with a little bit of water to get the right consistency.
All right, cool. So you got the thinned out yogurt, and then what are you adding to it?
I do finely chopped cucumber, a little bit of grated garlic. If you could find green garlic because it's spring, that'd be great.
It has a little bit of garlic, you just do like kind of microplane?
Microplane, yeah. Easy. And then walnuts.
Walnuts.
Toasted walnuts. Mm. Yeah.
And chopped up or what are those?
Chopped up. Yeah. Stirred in. And then we use Persian green raisins, which are definitely not easy to find.
Never even heard of them.
Which is why I didn't call for them. But we use golden raisins as a great sub and just soak them for a bit and then finally chop them and stir them into the yogurt. So you
do
have this.
Do you in water or vinegar or booze?
In water, some water. And then you have this kind of like sweet, crunchy, like cooling yogurt.
A little garlic in there.
And a little bit of garlic.
That's interesting. The other night, my wife made a yogurty dip for some sort of crudité action. And she put in the grated garlic, which I like, but sometimes it can be, you almost need something to sort of balance out that garlic, or else it can be
a little
very garlic forward.
I mean, we use one garlic clove as a sub for the green garlic for this recipe, and I think I call for 3 cups of.
Hold on a second. Where's my little recipe? Oh, here we go. The cucumber walnut yogurt. You have 3 cups of plain Greek yogurt.
One garlic clove.
And I assume with the yogurt, whole milk,
whole fat. Whole fat. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we have this. The table, bread. You got to have bread.
You got to have bread, yeah. We take bread seriously. I mean, I think definitely we take rice a lot more seriously, but we love bread. And this bread that I featured is barberry bread. And it's basically this, it's one of the thickest flatbreads you'll see around the world. And it's very, very long, or it can get very, very long, to up to like 4 or 5 feet long. It's insane.
And I notice it has kind of grooves to it.
Yes, absolutely. You create these kind of ridges with your fingertips. And it's not hard to prepare. It's what really gives it an amazing.
You just need a 4 foot long oven.
I shrunk the size a little bit. It didn't get that long. But you top it with sesame seeds and nigella seeds, and we love nigella seeds.
Talk to me about nigella seeds.
So they're not a sub for sesame seeds. I've seen it before in some recipes, not in Bon App, but where they think it's like a sub for sesame, but really it has an amazing smoky, slightly oniony flavor, and a little bit bitter. And you just top the barberry bread on top and some flaky sea salt. And it's incredible when it comes out of the oven.
Do you brush it with olive oil or anything?
Well, you brush it with this mixture of flour and hot water and baking soda, and it gives
That's crazy. Yeah. Why?
You get this crazy color on the bread.
I didn't know that. I should have read this recipe first. Sorry. Because it is nicely brown and stuff,
yes,
so that's not
absolutely.
From oil. Interesting. And then do you try to serve it warm, or you have too much going on?
You could serve it warm. You could serve it at room temperature. And this is actually, you could serve it with the meal. But since you have rice, I'll probably serve it this year with a platter of raw herbs and some radishes and then big hunks of salty cheese like feta.
During cocktail hour?
During cocktail hour. During tequila hour. And I mean, that's actually what was happening in my household. It was like they drank tequila before the meal. It's I don't know.
Wow.
It was just
crazy. California will do that to you. Do you just sort of tear the bread by hand?
The bread absolutely by hand. And then my mother, she would just put feta cheese out on the table and a platter of herbs and some soaked salty walnuts. But I like marinating the cheese with a little bit of oil and toasted spices.
Yeah, that sounds nice. All right, we have this delicious herbaceous springtime meal, and then after the meal apparently we have table games and brittle. Let's talk about that.
So the brittle that I featured is a riff on sohan, which is it's a brittle dish in Iran that has actually a lot of butter to it. I cut the butter and made it more into like of a crunchy brittle. The thing is, you end the meal.
Does the butter make it less brittle?
Yes.
So to speak? Okay. Yeah.
It gives it the less butter, it makes it more crunchy, yeah. basically. And then you have a table of pastries, but this was my favorite one.
So it's a brittle. So let's talk the brittle. You got
corn syrup. You got kind of the usual suspects in your brittle recipe. The corn syrup, some butter. But what makes this brittle really interesting is the saffron in it. Mm. You have a little bit of saffron that blooms in rose water. So you have rose water, saffron, two very Iranian ingredients. And then it's topped with crushed pistachios, dried rose petals, and flaky sea salt.
It's really beautiful looking with the green pistachios and the rose petals. Let's talk pistachios. It seems like there's perfectly fine pistachios and then there's good ones and you can taste the difference. Am I right?
God, you're going to hate me. I asked my mother to send me the pistachios. No. I swear. I brought them here.
You live in a city of 11 million people or whatever, and you can't get a decent pistachio?
No, you can. You definitely can. I think I'm just too cheap, but I want my mother to send me pistachios still. You can find great pistachios. I mean, California pistachios are great. Go California. But the thing is, my grandparents still bring pistachios from Iran. And so they'll bring it to my parents' house. And then I'm like, well, what are you doing with all these pistachios? Send me some. So it's just, I feel like it's easy for to send.
Wait, the ones that are they shelled or not shelled?
She sent me ones that are shelled. Uh-huh. I prefer the ones that are shelled just because they're easier to work with. Because I use them more cooking-wise. Like I'll add them to salads or desserts. Or make a sauce with them rather than eating them as a snack, which Iranians, typically how they eat them. They'll have like a beer with pistachios.
Yeah. Well, Andy Baraghani, I'm looking forward to the Persian New Year.
I'm looking forward to having you.
March 21st. Check out Andy's article in the March issue of Bon Appetit on Stands Now. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Adam.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.